Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics. I'm your host, Paul Loughlin, and with me today is Sarah Barr-Miller. Sarah is another Dunhumby alumni, we've had a few, and having previously worked with Alison Williams, who was my guest back on episode 38. Sarah now looks after the data function for British Airways, having spent all of her career actually leading data initiatives. She's very passionate about what data can unlock within a business and has now worked in a very diverse range of industries. So plenty to hear about, and I hope plenty you can relate to as the listener. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you, Paul. Hi, everybody.
Good to have you here with us. I'm looking forward to hearing some of that passion for data-driven change and exploring what you've learned along the way. So let's get cracking where I've started with all the guests on this podcast. It's to ask them to share a bit of their career history, their backstories, so everyone listening knows where you're coming from. So could you tell me a bit about your background, Sarah, and how you've ended up becoming a data leader?
Yeah, certainly. I think when you look back, it was kind of always obvious that I'd end up somewhere in the data perspective. Mm-hmm. Although I suppose I don't have a typical education, but then that's not surprising as somebody that went to university in the 90s, because there wasn't a huge amount ready available for us then. Sure. I'm quite lucky because I'm really quite passionate about words and about sort of data and mathematics, okay. Which I find is a bit of a cunning skill in a way. I did geography at university, and while that may surprise people in the data perspective, when I worked at Dunhumby, geography I think was almost one of the most popular degree disciplines of any of the people working in that data and insight space. It kind of makes you a kind of you're good at a broad range, so you're sort of a jack of all trades in a nice way. So I studied up in Leeds, where I absolutely loved, and then stepped into my first data role at a company that basically hire people that have done geography degrees at Leeds. It's quite specialist. Okay. Very tiny, working all just in the data realm. In those days we were doing modeling for where we would site car garages based on population data and things like that. But it really gave me a taste of what life in the sort of data world would look like. And I remember really clearly why I chose that role. I did a module in my geography degree where we were looking at population data using SPSS and all sorts of old style languages and things like that now. And I remember my peers all sitting around me who love writing essays, probably didn't like the sort of math side of things, looking at me as if to say, what on earth are you doing? Because I just sort of came alive. It just sort of clicked into place. But I did double maths A level, so in a way, logic was something that that sort of came quite naturally to me in a way. Mm. So I remember from that point thinking, yeah, there's something in this. It was still quite new. So I did this temporary work up in Leeds with this particular company, and then went off to travel the world, as a lot of people with a geography background obviously go on to do. So then found myself settled in London. I really wanted to find the next role in a data world where data roles were pretty uncommon. And I've had some really lucky moves in my career, one of which was my first role, which is actually Arcadia, who own brands like Topshop and Dorothy Perkins and Topman and people like that, working in the pre-internet ordering age, if anyone can possibly remember that far back, working with the data that came out of their home shopping catalogue. And, you know, working on core things like how many people bought two of the same items and then returned one. So how you could help customers to understand their sizing better and things like that. You know, it was really quite data heavy and analytical at the same time. Those two sort of two functions were sort of quite merged. But we looked after data that arrived on tapes every week. You know, we had to load it up into our warehouse. It was really a really good grounding in data and sort of very early analytics. Then Philip Green came in and basically made our whole function redundant. But in a way, that was a really good step. I'd been there 2 years, I'd learned loads. And then my next role that I managed to find was at dunnhumby, as you rightly say in my intro. And I was there for a good 12 years in total. Wow. Sort of man and boy in a way. I joined when I was 25, which was a fabulous time to join that company. There were 300 of us when I joined. So I was introduced to absolutely everybody on my day one. And in a way, it's almost like a training boot camp for everybody in the data space, but also in kind of customer centricity. And also, it really helped you understand what your strengths were and how they would operate with others. Because dunnhumby is a lot about really maximizing your strengths. You know, it's got really diverse group of people that work there, but fundamentally they're all about trying to improve themselves as individuals. So unwittingly, I sort of stepped into a career there that very, very quickly took me on a data path. So I'd already always worked in data up to that point, but really this is where I sort of honed my speciality. I started very much at the bottom. There was this amazing construct called the Trigger Monitor, which basically watched for data arriving from Tesco in those days, as it was at the start when that was our only client. And you would wait for the jobs to either succeed or fail. And then if they would go red if they'd fail, and they'd go green or they'd go amber if there was like some issues in the logs that you had to look into. It was actually a very crafty and quite clever way of managing feeds of data. And we got a man every week delivering us tapes of data from Tesco's, you know, loading them up on the mainframe. It was, yeah, a really good introduction. And, you know, I did that role for quite a significant period of time, really, to understand basically pure ETL, understanding in those days how to be a sort of DBA, understanding to work with analysts to make sure that the data was right. And they've also got a really clear distinction between what's a data task and what's an analytical task. And again, that was something that seemed so natural, but upon reflection is not so natural in other organizations. But it was just a fabulous learning curve, really, and a business that has a really clear identity and real, like, it doesn't apologize for the fact that it's passionate about data. Because back in 2003 when I joined, I think, you know, that there was some, and there still is today in a way, a kind of embarrassment that you're a technical person and you like the world of technicality. So data's quite like that, I think. Whereas, you know, dunnhumby, that's part of their, you know, on their mast and their flag, you know, it's their data first and customer centric first. So again, a really good education, I think. And I think from there, I realized that I also loved people, which I've always known, obviously, but loved working with people and loved mentoring and coaching, and eventually stepped into more managerial tasks, which I really, really enjoyed. But I think the most defining, again, part of my career at dunnhumby was where I ended up for the last sort of 5 years or so. As you probably know, dunnhumby started and it worked with Tesco principally, and then over time we've sort of grown and signed up new retailers around the globe, and I became part of that international team. So we did a Tesco international piece where we brought in all of Tesco sort of subsidiaries, but this was almost in a sales role, really. You'd be flown to random country, you'd come in on a Monday morning, you know, Sarah, can you be in Buenos Aires on Wednesday? Go on then. I can do that. And you were part of a sales function that ostensibly I was there as a sort of technical part of that sales team to understand what data they had and make sure that what we were promising them from a solution perspective was doable. But really, I was there to understand and absorb as much as I possibly could do from these retailers and really sell in the benefits of being customer centric and data first. So really, really interesting part of my life. I mean, it wasn't particularly great from a work-life balance, in the sense that, you know, being flown to Buenos Aires on a Wednesday meant I usually had to cancel gig tickets and things like that, which, you know, living in London, I was very keen to keep. but it taught me just an incredible amount. All the way from, I suppose, negotiating at sea level, because they wanted to, you know, bring us in and understand what other retailers were doing. Their eyes very much were on, you know, tell us what does our data look like? Is it better than Tesco's? Is it worse than Tesco's? Tell us what we're doing wrong.
Yeah.
So quickly developing that point of view, and also how to, you know, sort of make friends and influence people, because I would be brought in and I would be essentially toe to toe with whoever looked after, usually IT. They didn't often have data experts, but often IT, to say, we are going to need all of your data because we really need to understand your customers and what they're doing. And that was a lot of work. So to be able to justify that, and also to be able to convey to whomever was the data owner at that business that we weren't there to replace them, we were actually, you know, there to support them, because I think there was a lot of slight confusion, really. If you take out our analytics, what are we left with? And of course you're left with just more analytics, because more people have got more questions that we all need to answer. So trying to convey that in a way that was meaningful, and particularly doing that in other languages. I remember very clearly one of my really defining moments. I was sent to Brazil and Colombia on a back-to-back trip. So I did a week in each back-to-back. And when I was in Colombia, while they spoke really, you know, amazing English, they weren't happy conducting the technical levels of conversation in English. So they brought in an interpreter. And I remember very clearly, I'd ask a question, and they would then spend 10 or 15 minutes sometimes essentially arguing amongst themselves as to what the right answer would be. And given that they were from Latin America, it was a very passionate conversation. And I thought, gosh, I've only really asked how, you know, how promotions work and things like that through the till system. But they, just came back to me then with almost like a one sentence answer, which generated, you know, 15 minutes of quite, excitable chat. So, a really, really, really fun time. But I think one of the things it also taught me is that, you know, I started doing that role probably in my early 30s. And I was blessed in those days to not look my age. I'm walking into a room in an IT world, in a retailer, which mostly is dominated by men, white men in their 50s, typically, when you think about it like that. It can be quite hierarchical. So doing meetings in Japan, for example, where you have to, you're very deferential to the most senior man, usually in the meeting room. So learning how different cultures work and being able to hold my own. I suppose, you know, Dunnhumby were fabulous at giving people just about enough stretch so that they felt that they were being supported, but also were doing something, you know, pretty cool from their perspective. So taught me a lot. But ultimately, time came when I wanted to settle down, have children, and that kind of lifestyle just doesn't really fit, does it, in a lot of ways? So it taught me an awful lot. I had a global team that spanned all the way from Montreal in Canada to Shanghai in China. So team meetings was usually quite an entertaining time. we were very virtual, which is you know, it's a good skill to learn, given that that's how we've been operating for the last sort of 2 years nearly. It gave me lots and lots and lots of learnings, and really helped sort of hone my data pedigree, I suppose, in some instances. But the time came to make a change, and my husband and I at that time really wanted to leave London. Nowadays, I think it's very different, because I work for a company based in London, but I'm still based up in Cheltenham in Gloucestershire. So life's different now. But in those days, work-life balance essentially meant leaving the role that you were in and moving somewhere else, which at the time was a relatively large move. But it also provided me with the opportunity to lead insight. So I moved from data, and I wanted to round my skill set out, I think, around the sort of insight side of things. So being a customer of data, I suppose, you get to see it from the completely different side and a different perspective.
Absolutely.
I'd always been like really close to what my customers wanted, because that's in the nature of doing, you know, being a good data leader. But at the same time, I never really felt like I had enough knowledge to really get it, you know, take a walk in their shoes. So I then moved to UCAS, who manage everyone's application to university, and worked very much. I set up a consultancy business to use the data that UCAS have to to help universities as businesses to attract the right types of applicants and to work out where their market share was lower, where they're losing out to competitors, very much brought an angle of like business to what they were trying to do. And did that, led a team of analysts, which again, I've never done before. But I relished the opportunity. And again, I learned so much in that 4-year period. But when we then all went into lockdown, I think like many people around the country really wanted to think about what do I really enjoy and what motivates me to get out of bed in the morning. So when you're sitting like I am in my spare room, usually with the dog to one side of me, like, what do I want to be doing in my day job, and what change do I want to create? And I very clearly felt that I wanted to get back to the data space. So started sort of looking around and applied for, again, like you, I mean, it was quite weird on LinkedIn. For those of you who are job hunting or have done it recently, applying to one of those job adverts where they don't tell you the company and they don't tell you the salary. But at the time it sounded interesting. And I think it was one of those things, I was probably a Friday afternoon, I just thought, well, that's worth a punt, isn't it? Sent my CV off and got a phone call later that, I think it was the same day, if not the next day, to say, oh, good, your sign. Skills really fit. Yeah, that's true. Although I don't, in reality, really remember that I'd done it. It was one of those things that you just kind of see and think, oh, that's worth a punt. Mm. But they rang me back straight away. And very apologetically, the recruiter, who is absolutely fabulous, sort of mentioned, yeah, it was, the roles with British Airways, and they said it in such an apologetic way because we were in the height of lockdown. And but of course I was like, well, I for one know I want to get back on holiday and back in the sky, so I can't be the only one. And if they're committed to improving their data capability, then I for one don't mind joining an organization who might find themselves in a bit of flux and a bit of change. But and so now that's where I lead. I joined them mid-April this year. So I've only really been with them nearly 3 months, and just been spending a lot of time understanding the sheer scale of the data warehouse and the data estate that we've got at BA. As you can imagine, we don't just have customers making data, we have planes making data, we have crew making data, we've got 35,000 employees making data. So yeah, it's pretty vast as an ecosystem. So that's where you find me at the moment.
Fabulous. Thank you, Sarah. Gosh, what a interesting career, and lots to potentially follow up there. There's all sorts of things it's prompted in my own memories and experience, but I'll try and focus myself. So keeping a bit of memory here, let me just go back to, I've got to pick up on the geography degree and the obvious maths background as well. I empathize a lot with the relevance, because I haven't mentioned this, I don't think, before on the podcast, but my first degree was in meteorology, oceanography and astronomy. So quite kind of geography related as well. I wonder, as you've kind of built on it in your career, what do you see as having been the advantages, because you kind of hinted toward it, of that humanities and mathematics, that words and numbers kind of ability?
Well, I think so, because I think and this is a real example of what I'm trying to do at the moment. So I'm about to present to the exec in a couple of weeks around our strategy for how we're going to modernize a lot of our data architecture and estate.
Okay.
And the ability to be able to communicate why we're doing something, what we're doing, and the benefits that you'll get out of doing it really come from a love of words and a love of communication, which I suppose the humanities background provides for me. I also did psychology A level, so it's kind of all in that mix. And I find, you know, maths has given me a very logical mindset and a way of approaching a problem, which I think all data professionals and insight professionals have as a kind of root skill. But I think for being able, this passion to communicate is really, really strong. I'm a massive extrovert. So I think I'm quite unusual. And particularly when I've managed analytical teams, I'm definitely the unusual one in that team. But I think it helps, because if to lead data, you've got to be an evangelist, and you can't really, in my perspective, be a sort of quiet evangelist. You can do it by through results, but you've got to be able to explain what you're doing. Because I was joking to my team only this morning that the presentation that I've started for me was it had nothing technical in it. It was all for laymen. And when I've shown it to my my director, he actually described it, well, you know, it's all going to be Klingon to the likes of the exec team. And I was like, oh gosh, you know, crikey, in this day and age. But it just shows you, you know, that we forget how much knowledge we've implicitly got by working in data for, you know, for the last 20 odd years. It's that ability to then be able to communicate and drive that passion and enthusiasm. You know, you can't convey that unless you love words, in my mind anyway.
Yeah, absolutely true. And your extrovert enthusiasm shines through in your voice as well, Sarah, don't worry. That's great. That makes good sense to me, and I resonate with that. It's funny, I'm thinking now, it's becoming a bit of a cause célèbre on this podcast that we keep banging on about leaders who haven't come from a data science or pure maths and stats background, and recruiters should think broader, and potentially people who are early in their career don't rule out data and analytics if you've had a humanities background. So
absolutely.
Next thing I was going to pick up on, you obviously feel you benefited greatly from your time at Dunnhumby. I've heard that consistently from others who've been there as well. I guess some listeners could begin to think that their work was associated with some terms you touched on, actually. Single customer views, lifetime value models, customer centricity. Mm-hmm. Concepts that are perhaps a bit less fashionable now when it's all talk about data products and process automation and that kind of more machine learning optimization kind of mindset. Why do you think such customer-centric thinking is still relevant for today's data leaders?
I mean, all of those concepts are relevant, aren't they? And, you know, my team are organised in an agile way around core products. We've got an automation team for robotics. So we've embraced all of the modern day thinking, but at the heart of it, I think you still need a why. Why are we doing all of these things? Usually it's to improve a customer's experience with you so that they either purchase with you more or become more loyal to you. I mean, that's obviously the realm that I've always worked in. And so I don't think those concepts are dead. I really don't. And it's also quite surprising still how many organizations have still not cracked it. So although they've been around, and I remember doing my first lifetime value model in my first role when I got to London in the year 2000. So we're talking a long time ago now.
Yeah.
But still, we're still having a very healthy debate in BA about how you measure loyalty. Is it spend? Is it number of visits? Is it share of wallet? Is it, you know, there's loads of ways to cut that.
Yeah.
So if we're still having that conversation in a really, you know, wonderful way at BA, then there are hosts of other companies still grappling with the same things. It's not to say that they're not grappling the new things as well, but there's still fundamentals that are true today as they were 20 years ago.
Yeah, completely agree, Sarah. And I think sadly, because not so many are banging the drum for them, there's a risk of a new generation coming in who aren't steeped in those concepts, and all they've learned is data product and process optimization kind of thing, and that the customer should be grateful for getting what the machine says. When we spoke before, and again actually you've touched on it in what you shared, so thank you for that. I remember you being passionate about the distinction you mentioned that Dunnhumby emphasized between data teams and analytics teams, and I guess allowing both to be masters of their own discipline. I was going to say masters of the universe. That must be in a retro mindset.
Absolutely true, yep.
could you tell us a bit more about why you feel that matters? Because as you mentioned, there are a lot of businesses who don't have firm distinctions between those teams.
Yeah, and I think maybe this is a sort of historical piece for me. You know, this is where I've grown up, but I'm having this very real conversation as I step into BA as well. But I do believe that we have different areas of expertise. There are certain core skills that both analysts and data professionals share. Absolutely. We talk similar languages. But I do feel that there's a difference in skill set. So I'm really passionate that you just allow both teams to flourish at what they do best. And that's not, I think some people read that negatively and that, you know, all analytics team get to do the exciting ML and all the rest of it. But they'd be nowhere without the data for which to do that on. Mm-hmm. And that real key kind of understanding of customer behavior you can only get through the data. So I think you let data people be absolutely passionate, like I am, about data quality, data governance, all the things that potentially an analytics team may not be so passionate about. and you let the analytical team focus on improving customer experience through creating algorithms, through whatever other, you know, statistical concepts they want to wrap around that data, but that you don't leave them to create their own data silos, their own version of the truth. You know, you create and make it easy for them to do the analytics that you really need. So if you need, if you want a sort of data a well-versed company in data, you can only do that by putting the right insight in the right places. It's not about then making everybody do data, it's about embedding that insight. So for me it feels, it's a real bugbear of mine when I see poor analysts having to wade through data quality and trying to understand how to unpick the ETL processes. That's not the right use of their time. It's how they can maximize value. Data's intrinsically worthless unless you do something with it, so let teams focus on doing something with it.
Yeah, nicely put, Sarah. I was reminded how much, after all the initial buzz of the launch of data science back, it feels like about a decade ago, I guess now, how much so many businesses have come to almost a rediscovery of, oh, actually, we more needed data engineers.
Yeah,
oh, actually, absolutely. We now need a data ops focus. It's, in a way, it's just a rediscovery of what you've said, that specialization matters. So, well made is a point. I'm sure many listeners will also really relate to the challenge you shared, and thanks for being so open with us, around all the travel and also the kind of turning up with an unfamiliar, mainly old, white and male or boardroom, and needing to influence these people who, you shared some of the reasons, might feel a bit defensive. You're on their patch. Why do you want their data? Are you going to make some of their internal functions redundant? I wonder what you learnt about how to influence them. And I'm particularly interested whether you felt you had to do anything particularly differently because you were a woman in that situation.
Yeah, I think it's the reality that there aren't as many people in the data specialism who are female for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And I think when I listened to Alison's podcast, a lot of what she talked about resonated with me. You kind of feel like you have to do more than your male counterparts may do and almost be a superhuman version of yourself. And I think you quickly learn that that's pretty exhausting and on a path to nowhere. And I think what I focused on really was knowing my craft and knowing my trade. So I as a person, I hate being I'm very happy to wing things if I know the background and I know the context, but I'm really not happy to wing things in an environment where I don't feel like I have enough knowledge. So I very much love that kind of learning, that discovery phase. Talking to people obviously helps, but I really felt like I had to just focus on knowing as much about things as I possibly could do. So it does feel tricky when you've got that imposter syndrome. This was before that was even a term, but I certainly had a lot of that walking into it. I think I'm quite lucky because I'm naturally a relatively confident person, so I didn't really let that get in my way. And let's also not forget that half of Dunnhumby is a very influential and very very smart woman. I think at Dunnhumby your gender matters. It's completely irrelevant. It's essentially what you're good at. I think in more so I've probably felt that outside. So when I have been, as you rightly call out, when I've been visiting like retailers around the globe, but again, most of the time I was always partnered with other females in that domain. So actually I always felt part of a team rather than I am a woman doing this role. So for me, I've been very lucky, I think. I mean, I do reflect back on the times where these things pop up, don't they, from things like Facebook. And I remember a post I put literally donkeys years ago, and it was something I commented on. I said, yes, I'm out with 12 men. It must be the data team night out, because most of my team were male. And, and the same is true in the team I lead at the moment. But I think by looking to more diverse backgrounds, potentially, I think you can help in that, redress that balance, because I'm all for helping anybody in their role irrespective of their gender, but I'm definitely very kind to other women in their journey, because I know it can be a little bit tougher. But I think I was quite lucky, you know, as I say, half of Dunnhumby is a very powerful woman, so you quickly realize that it's just about the skills that you bring.
That makes good sense. You've referenced her a few times. Did Edwina Dunn do anything internally within Dunnhumby to kind of mentor or help women in data to develop back even then?
I think her role really was, as she was a figurehead, she implicitly helped people along that journey without really even trying. And she was a great speaker. So she used to speak at pretty much every single company do we ever had. So it was, again, because I was in my early 20s, it just seemed normal that one of your leaders was a female. Latterly, they've set up a whole range of different communities to support not just women, but obviously people from other diverse backgrounds. So they've set up that more sort of community base now. But at the time, again, I don't think she would have liked to have been viewed as a female lead. But she was just very, very intelligent and brilliant at what she did. So she did spend a lot of time with people, but actually I used to get more time with Clive because he was on the more technical side anyway. So those meetings were like gold dust, where you'd come out with your head absolutely fizzing off your shoulders because it was just so full of new things to think about. But yeah, she was a very approachable person. She, you know, like they both were actually. So, and they did a lot for their staff in the days before that was even really that popular. Company, you know, company dues, and they every year we had a summer party where it was designed that partners were invited. And she always gave a big thank you to and a shout out to those who supported people that worked at Dunnhumby. Which I think was quite important to recognize that you are a rounded human, not just somebody that turns up to work.
Good point as well. I also wonder, when I was kind of hearing you're overcoming the challenge and what helped you in terms of influencing these boardrooms, I was kind of struck, I guess, you're leaning into your strengths of knowing your stuff, if I put it that way, and feeling comfortable that you were technically expert enough and that confidence comes through. Did you find that not wanting to completely wing it put you at odds with other salespeople who might be with you? Not casting aspersions, but sometimes that role can be very good at completely making it up. Was that attention or was there a valuing of your expertise as part of the team?
Oh no, absolutely the latter. So I think Dunnhumby doesn't really employ technical like salespeople, because in a way you're selling something that people will want. So it's a very easy sales job in some regards. The concept before it was even a concept was that for every sort of sales pitch you had a bit of a multidisciplinary team. So there'd be somebody representing the analytics, somebody representing the data, depending on the type of client. And then there'd be somebody on the kind of business benefits and you know, the more sales side of things, let's say. So I think because it's a company so grounded in its knowledge and its data and its pedigree, that all of those skills are really, really valued. You never felt like you were, as a data team, a commodity that you had to justify, or a cost base, which I know a lot of other data leaders can struggle with, you know, justifying why they exist. That doesn't really happen in Dunnhumby in the same way, because you don't have to justify the value you bring, because you're an enabler for everything else that happens downstream. So I think all of those skills are really respected.
Good to hear. Another thing I've asked just about every leader who's come on the podcast is to spare a bit of time, if you like, in our conversation, to pause and recognise a number of the people who listen to this podcast are earlier in their career. They're kind of more that's kind of early analyst, maybe still deciding where to focus, what to learn. I wonder, looking back now and what you've learned being a manager and a leader as well, what tips do you have for those who are earlier in their data analytics career? What skills and knowledge would you encourage them to focus on developing?
Yeah, I mean, this is a brilliant question, isn't it? So I think back to that winging it point earlier, now I'm very comfortable. I'm a great winger, but I really wanted to know my craft. So spend the time understanding and reading. There's so much out there now, and there's so many amazing places to get your knowledge from. So just spend a bit of time investing and reading around your subject, really know your stuff. But I think the one thing that I perhaps hadn't focused on enough, and latterly, and this is I've really honed this in the last few years when I was at UCAS, is around telling your data story. Right. So again, this comes back to communication, but really everything around data, if you're justifying how long a project takes, or explaining some analytics, or talking about what you want the team to focus on, it's about taking people on that journey and telling a story. One of my great bosses, gosh, back in probably the early 2000s, a lovely chap called Matthew Green, he said, Sarah, you're fabulous at what you do, but you really struggle to take people with you. And all feedback, I love feedback, but that really stayed with me because at the time I really, in a way, didn't understand what he meant. So in my sort of early career, I just thought, well, you know, I'm doing a great job. I'm getting loads of things delivered, tick, 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 you know. But what I struggle to realize and what I, you know, spend my time now talking to my teams about is that you've got to go back to where those teams are and really take them with you so that they understand the change, because data is all about change. You know, you very rarely in a data realm or an analytics realm sit still for too long. So why are you making that change to either your operating model or your ways of working or your technology stack, or why are you making that change? So for me, that focusing on communication, focusing on the why. I spend my life talking to people at the moment where, you know, they're trying to implement a change. And I'm like, well, why is this happening? Why are we doing it? What benefits do I get? So focusing on outcomes and benefits rather than the actual nuts and bolts of how you're going to do something. While that is important for me, that the why needs to really be first and foremost in people's minds.
Great advice. And yeah, as you mentioned, it struck me a few times through our conversation, you've come back to that why. It's a powerful question and a good direction to give people. If analysts are listening and you want to take up that suggestion from Sarah of more reading around this, I'd recommend Storytelling with Data by Cole Nussbaum and Affleck. That's a great book. Resonate by Nancy Duarte is great as well. Both those women have written really well, I think, about that storytelling and influencing people with your story. So good point.
It's such a powerful skill, because that's the only way to take people on that journey, is really describing what you mean. And some things that will seem so obvious to you as someone who's a data or an insight professional will not be obvious to someone that hasn't worked in that field. So you forget how much you know. And I think the other bit of advice, you're talking about how I've managed to influence and sort of feel confident walking into that space. It's the same for when you're early in your career. Don't forget, you know more than everybody else does. So you're walking into a boardroom, they're looking at you for the information. So don't forget that you'll be the most knowledgeable there. And I think that's always a powerful reminder.
Yeah, well said, Sarah. Okay, final question. This has been a great journey. Thank you for how much you've had to share with us. Can you give us an example of something you've changed your mind on in the last few years? And I ask leaders this because it's just to bring to life, even for people who've been as successful in their career as you have and others on this podcast, it's not about being a finished article. It's about still recognizing it's learning and growing and improving. So what about you, Sarah? What have you changed your mind on in the last few years?
I mean, I do this a lot because I love talking to people and I love getting their perspectives on things. So then last week I conducted sort of skip level meetings, as they're kind of famously called. But, you know, speaking to my team's team to understand what they're up to, what their challenges are, things that maybe they're not telling their line managers. And so that I'm hopefully getting quite a lot of honesty. So I think they're a wonderful way of understanding where people are. And it's part of our operating model that I inherited that was just being changed was to move to a sort of DevOps model. And while it's something I fundamentally do believe in, again, we're changing our minds to think, actually, do we need to consolidate ops for a bit, let it stabilize while some other changes come in, and then we roll out a bigger change? Moving, is it a smart idea to move to functional lead as well as the sort of more pastoral line management lead? So somebody would be managed in a couple of ways. How do we implement multidisciplinary teams? Is it right for us? So while I probably, it's not something I've changed my mind on and absolutely, you know, think something's right or something's wrong, it gives an indication that these are big concepts and big changes for people, and we debate them because there's no blueprint for anything that we're doing. All of us as data leaders probably have a lot within our gift that we can change and influence. And these are things that you can influence and change and implement in your team. So, we're not nobody is a finished article. And no team and no operating model is a static one either. So it's, I suppose for me, it's less about changing my mind, though I do that an awful lot, but more about the fact that everything is fluid and everything changes. And the sort of the way you approached a problem 5 years ago then might have changed 2 years ago, and you've gone back to the way of thinking that you did 5 years ago. So it all comes around in sort of circles. And I think that's fine. I think it's absolutely fine. So it definitely is a space, particularly on how we operate with each other and how we should be working, that my set model has changed probably 15 times in the last 20 years or so as to how things should be operating. So things are fluid, things change, things don't stay the same. And I think that is a really good learning, that when you are going through your career, there is no gold standard. There's no blueprint that you can pull out straight from a book, because it all depends on your context. So yeah, change it all the time. And I love hearing people's opinions on what's working and what's not.
Great. Good advice. I like the ethos of that, both the openness to change and the learning from listening to people to really understand a context rather than coming in with your fixed ideas. Good advice for leaders. Thank you very much, Sarah, for your time today. It's been a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you, Paul. It's been lovely to share my thoughts. You never get that opportunity in normal life, so it's a pleasure.
And a pleasure to listen to you too. And thank you, everybody, for listening. I hope you found that helpful, and continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcast. More great interviews coming up, and each week there's also fresh content on our blog, customerinsightleader.com. So you might want to check that out too. Before then, thanks everyone for your time. Have a great week and enjoy continuing to grow and listen as a leader in your field. Bye for now.